If your brain feels like it's constantly buffering, if your calendar is full, but your clarity is gone, if you're doing everything right, but still feel one dropped ball away from everything crashing, then this episode is for you. Because high performance isn't sustainable when your executive functioning system is running on fumes. And no, more strategy won't fix it. Today, we're talking about the real architecture behind effective leadership. Prioritizing under pressure, regulating when it matters, and sustaining your capacity without sacrificing yourself. This conversation is for the leader who's built a lot, but secretly wonders why it still feels so hard. Welcome to today's Balanced Leader, where we don't do fluff. We name what's not working and we reclaim what will. Let's get into it. Dr. Anna Levy Warren brings over 20 years of psychology, leadership, and insight, plus real-world experience helping overwhelmed people reclaim clarity, calm, and effectiveness in how they lead and how they live. She's a clinical psychologist and founder of Organizational Tutors, which we'll hear more about. But Anna's work focuses on strengthening executive functioning, which is the essential skills like organization, emotional regulation, and decision-making that helps leaders, teams, and individuals navigate stress and complexity without burning out. She's also the co-founder of Dwellness and Steel Advising, supporting individuals, teams, and families in building emotional resilience, stronger cognitive skills, and sustainable success in fast-paced environments. So if you're a high achiever, a leader, or a change maker, and you push through the chaos every day, this episode's for you. But understanding how your brain works is the key to leading with more clarity, calm, and real impact. So let's get started. Anna, welcome to today's Balanced Leader. I would say a lot of leaders and individuals that I'm coaching lately, they're finding that life feels louder, faster, more overwhelming for so many of them. And you know, in my coaching sessions, I see people running nonstop, but they feel scattered, they don't feel purposeful, they feel reactive, and that they're disconnected. Are you seeing these patterns in your world? And can you share an example of how that impacts a leader's ability to stay organized and grounded?
Yeah, of course. I mean, honestly, that is the number one complaint I think I hear, and especially because I work with a lot of people who have these kind of executive functioning challenges, which just means that life feels more overwhelming and sort of more exhausting in that way. And it's just a really challenging part of these devices and being able to be constantly reached and having things pop up. And we are sort of being told by the things around us that we should be multitasking all the time when actually we're not really capable of it. And most people can't shift sets, meaning like go back and forth between things in the way that they think they can. So instead of being able to thoughtfully and intentionally consider what is most important, we're being told what's most important and reacting to it in sort of an emergency crisis style, which means that the things just fall off at the bottom of that barrel or pile without you even knowing that that necessarily happened. So I think there's just a million examples of that from the smallest moment in a day where you're sitting there, you know, working on a project or a brief or a PowerPoint or whatever version of it you have. And, you know, somebody emails you or texts you or calls you and you respond to that. And then you lose where you were in the other thing you were doing and really kind of lose your train of thought and how you were thinking about something. And then you may not even get back to it, because you may actually have lost your view on it. So that's like the tiniest daily example. But then there's also just like the larger life example where there's so many things flooding you all the time that you can't make intentional choices about actually living your values, right? Of saying, oh, you know, family, lots of people say to me, family is so important to me. And it's like, when did the last time you had family dinner? And they can't remember because there's so many things coming up in a daily way that really derail you. So I think there's both that sort of small individual moment in a day and those larger sort of week, month, year examples that really take us out of it. And I think the way that I really like to talk to my own clients about this and think about it is around how do we get intentional, purposeful, and out of reactivity by creating really, you know, the word safe, that's different meanings for different people, like safe spaces to say, I'm not taking that kind of input right now. I'm really focused on this thing. So I really work with people on having structure and intention in their day that reflects their priorities and really outlines the time necessary, and then really blocks those sort of external stimulus from coming in with more assertion of, I'm actually not available for that kind of reactivity right now. And I think that that is a really hard practice, and it has a lot of emotional implications to it, because it's hard to say no to people, and it's hard to say I'm unavailable, and it's hard to say I'm doing this and not that. So there's just a lot of layers that go into something that seems simple, like, oh, just push do not disturb. It's like, that's actually really complicated, you know, and lots of people break through your do not disturb, and people open your door, and people call you. So how do you manage that? And that's how I like to think about it.
Yeah, and my mind goes a mile a minute because even when I was in the corporate world, I used to practice that mindfully. And I love how you talk about intentionality because it's a word I use in coaching a lot. Everything you do has to have an intention towards what you're doing. Otherwise, what's the point of doing it, really? Right. So how do you set up your calendar? And I know you're a big proponent of the calendar. There's a start,
I
there's an end, guys.
Yeah, I love the calendar. I'm very focused on it.
You have to have white space to be able to be creative, to focus, and finding out when you're most creative. For me, it's usually morning and end of day. But I think the other piece too is you also talked about what you let in. And we did talk a little bit about when you open up your phone or your newspaper or whatever and the news. And I love how you talked to me prior to hitting record about when you scan something, looking at how it actually impacts you personally. Does it really influence you? Because just absorbing everything sometimes can be overwhelming and spiral you, so you can't be intentional. And so I would love to explore a little bit more around, maybe give an example of a couple of things that you do when we talk about our calendar, the start, the end of the day. What does that look like for Anna?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I have a real obsession with a calendar because I think that it's a, don't laugh, it's a tool, and also it's a relationship. And I really believe in that. And I really believe that the calendar is a relationship that we have to have in this moment in time. And that it's a relationship because it allows you to have this kind of intentionality and purpose. It allows you to think about time as a resource and how you want to utilize it to reflect the things that are important to you. And it allows you an opportunity to reflect on what worked and what didn't work in a really intentional way. And actually to model that, you know, if for the parents out there, for the children, but also for people who work with you, and to say what is possible and not, and to really consider the emotional impact of the things that you take in and don't in your day, which also helps determine when you do and do not do them, right? So, you know, what we have resources for, like, you know, Pink's book, When, like, how do we think about when we do things so carefully? When is it creative process? When is my brain most sort of on fire? And I also really think a lot about cognitive depletion, right? Like, our sort of like cognitive overload and how much information comes in. And as well as ego depletion, which is like the idea that self-control is a limited resource and can be depleted after use. So we really want to think about all of these things when we think about our day. So for me, right, I do a lot of work on having anchors in my day. So things that I always know will be there and are emotionally positive for me. So that's my cup of coffee in the morning and doing a little bit of Wordle. And I have a friend I talk to every morning, you know, and then there's a middle of the day where I always make sure to take a walk and see a friend for coffee because that's really fueling for me. And at the end of the day, I'm really sure about, like, I always read and I have a conversation with another friend to just make sure that I have this arc. So I have these anchors in my day that are beginning, middle, and end. And the more routinization we have of these things, with the more automaticity, and then the less depleting they are and overloading they are. So that's why I really like to think about both emotional impact and strategically managing a calendar. And I like to have those things reflected that I can look at and see. And I review my calendar both like every evening and every morning to make sure I have the space I need for not just practically like my meetings, but the emotional impact of my meetings and what they will feel like and what other resources I need in a day. You know, for example, if I have a podcast to record with you today, but I don't schedule clients right before, I have the time, but I won't be my best self with you because I'll be tired because I've given of myself in a particular way. But I do go and work out and I do go have a cup of coffee and I leave myself room to get ready in a way that I wouldn't otherwise. So I'm thinking about that all the time, both in terms of the relationships and how things activate my central nervous system, like we talked about, and then the practical implications of that and how I set my calendar based on those things.
Love that. I mean, there's so many tools. I think the calendar for me, similar to you, is so important. And I used to try and educate individuals because, of course, if you're an office individual, generally you'll see individuals have their email open because it's important. And of course, what you said, every time an email lands or it dings or whatever that is, it's going to distract you. It's going to pull you away from whatever your focus is. And I used to try and train people, instead of having your email open, have your calendar open, because your calendar will help you to focus on the things that you need to focus on. Again, you're setting intentionality, and to your point, through the anchors. And part of your calendar is actually blocking time where, okay, now I've got 30 minutes going over to email and I'm going to answer all the email responses. Or if somebody walks into your office saying, hey, Anna, I'd love to help you, but I'm just in the middle of finishing this off. Do me a favor. I want to give my full attention to you. So go ahead and block some time on our calendar where I can have dedicated time for you to support you on whatever it is that you need. You know, when we used to, as mothers, joke about when your child comes in, is it, you know, they'd interrupt a call. What was the saying? Is there blood? Is it broken bones? Is there a fire? Right. If not, then
out.
Right. I'll deal with it when I'm done. But I think, to your point, we've become so reactive in everything we do, and we wait for direction for people to come to us and tell us or ask of us. And at the end of the day, you're so overwhelmed and exhausted. And that's why you don't feel grateful at the end of the day, because what do you have to feel grateful about?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons you heard me just slip this in, but I am so dedicated to the people I love in my life. Like, friendship to me isn't just a sidebar. It's so central. And I deeply believe in the importance of relationships and the depth of connection and sort of intimacy and vulnerability in relationships. And so even if it's short, I will make sure that I see a person who does not live with me, you know, who is meaningful, who I have a good, who can I have a fully self-oriented, authentic conversation with every single day. And that fuels me and allows me to feel grateful every day, no matter what else is going on. And that's really important. And I think it's just gotten decentralized, and, you know, especially in remote work and the pandemic, that, you know, we see the people we live with, and we have to really, and we're tired and we're working. And then sometimes the whole day has gone by and you haven't done anything that actually feels good and fuels you and gives you the energy you need to do the other things you want to do.
Yes, absolutely agree with that. And I think the pandemic really highlighted that for a lot of us, because we saw a lot of people that felt that normally they were going along with life just absolutely fine. And then all of a sudden, when they were isolated, I think that relationship, that connection, that authentic partnership with somebody, or really knowing somebody and being able to talk to them, you could see which ones really struggled with. And I think it's a lost art of, you know, you used to talk about letter writing, where you'd write a letter to somebody and you'd get excited when you got it back and things like that. But I think we've lost that. There's, to me, I often talk a lot about it. There's a difference between friendships or relationships and just acquaintances. And it's not to diminish the acquaintances, but those aren't the individuals when I'm struggling on a particular day or when I'm excited about something I want to share. Those are probably not the individuals that I'm going to reach out to, right? So I always, to your point, love to reach out to those that I love. If I haven't heard from them for a couple of days, go, hey, no response needed. Just checking in. How are you? What's going on in your world? Or if they were going through something, did that resolve? Do you need more support? I'm always here for you. I think it's so important in today's world to be able to not feel like we've lost the purpose of living. Because, right? I mean, you think about why you work to have a better life. Well, if you're consumed by work, where's the better life? And
Yeah.
we've lost that.
Yeah, and people ask me all the time, like, I'm really interested in efficiency and effectiveness, and I think that's very important. It's in order to have the pleasure-filled time, the joy and the ease that I want in my day and that I want my clients to have, and I want the people I love to have. And I think it's so, you just named these different kinds of relationships, and I like to value them really intentionally also. Like, there are the people that you're your full authentic self with, and you can drop in, and they're beautiful and wonderful, and they're in the vulnerability. They also are the people that if you're having a bad day, you're like, oh, I'm having such a bad day, like, and you're pouty with them and hard. And there's actually, that's wonderful. And, I live in New York City, and there's the people that I know from my coffee shop and from my laundromat and from, and that I say hi to, and they know only the version of me that pops into the store for 6 minutes when I get a thing. But it, and it's not, it doesn't have that same dropped in vulnerability, but it does turn on a light in me and a connection energy. And it's part of myself that actually brings me up, right? Where, and those relationships we know from research are very important to be like, how are you? Good morning. That feeling of connection. And that actually also fuels us differently and keeps me out of sometimes the hard stuff that I'm going through and allows a connection without that loadedness. So I think there's all these different kinds of relationships, and you just don't want to, you really got to spread it out. You got to really think about, when is the time that you need that dropped in, checking in, how are you from your belly? And when is the time that you need it just in the like, keep you up, smile because you weren't smiling. And we know when you smile, all of a sudden you feel happier.
Absolutely. Yes, love that. Including your family. Yes.
Very much.
So
Whole different story. Yeah.
let's shift a little bit. On this podcast, we talk about strategic leadership, but strategy leadership isn't just about strategy. And I think it's about how we show up when things are tough, which we just talked about, right? When we're under pressure. So we're going to talk a little bit about executive functioning because I know that's your jam. But for someone who's new to understanding what executive functioning is, can you explain it kind of in real world terms, if you will, and how does it show up or fall apart when leaders are overwhelmed?
Great question. I will try to be as concise as possible in answering this, and just want to be honest that over the last 15 years, the definition of executive functions or executive functioning, it's really not one clear thing, because it's an umbrella term for an interrelated set of cognitive processes. So you're going to get some movement in there, but to me, it's really it's the air traffic controller of the brain, right? It's the delegator and the manager and trying to make sure everything works well. And what that at the synaptic level, at the core of the brain, it's really can be categorized as working memory, self-control, and mental flexibility. And now I'm going to say what those are, right? Working memory is our sort of housing and retrieving. It's not short-term or long-term memory. So my best example is, like, if there's a server at a restaurant and they're going around the table, when you have strong working memory, they look at you and they say, what's your order? And you say, I'd like a Diet Pepsi, hold the salt. I would really like some extra bread and no butter. And they look at you and they're like, okay, no problem. And you think, no chance. But they come back with your perfect order because they've taken in the information and they have mental little sticky notes in their brain and they put it there and then they spit it back out to the people in the kitchen. It's no problem. They organized it, they managed it, it comes out, no big deal. And then you have the person who comes around with their notepad and they're like, what would you like to drink? And they're like, Diet Coke. And they're like, Diet, what? I'm sorry, what? And you go back and forth and you think there's no chance. And there isn't a chance because they don't have the mental sticky note. And so that housing and retrieving is not accessible. And think about the impact of that every day, right? I think about associates at law firms are a great example of this and always struggle because there's so much verbal information. You walk into a partner's office and they say, get this. And they lost you at hello. They have no idea what you just said. And there's this panic look. And then what are you supposed to do? And it's terrible because there's no sticky note. So that's the working memory part. And then self-control sounds straightforward, but it's self-regulation, self-monitoring, and delayed gratification, which is, actually really well, it sort of the example of a marshmallow experiment from The Way of, which most people already know that reference. But the idea of that's really, it's more than self-control and sort of the most shallow version of that term. It's really how we monitor ourselves, how we wait for things, how we regulate our emotions. There's so much packed into it. And then mental flexibility is flexible thinking and transitions. It's like using information from one place, bringing it to another. It's shifting between sets. And also just going back to self-control, that's also where the attentional piece comes in. So the concrete manifestation of, people saying like, oh, executive functions are organization and attention and time management. Yes, based on these things. This is what our brains need to do that well. And really trying to, think about how much impact there is. And going back to your earlier question, when there's so much incoming information, you can really understand how we get so overloaded and depleted that these systems start to shut down. And everyone's executive functions get poorer when we are sleep deprived, emotionally overwhelmed, sick, when there's just cognitively overloaded. So even as a child, I used to make color-coded to-do lists for fun. Like I have strong executive functions, but give me a sick kid and a client in crisis, and for me, an asthma attack, and I will tell you right there that I cannot, that I'm like, where are my keys? I don't know where my keys are, and I will miss an appointment, or I will text a client and say, are we meeting today? My executive functions can struggle too. So there are people who struggle, and this is all laborious and exhausting every day, and you really know those people in terms of how they show up or what they don't remember and their lateness and they're dysregulated and you can see these things, but we all can be empathic and understand that there are moments where we all struggle with this. And we really did see that during the pandemic because everybody had a hard time. How
Yes.
was that? Did that capture
Yes.
it?
No, that was great. It was interesting because I love how you say you can actually have a great day, have a bad day, right? When you talk about depending on how much is brought over into your day. So my attitude is I always wake up, I have my non-negotiables of what I do before my feet hit the ground. I'm probably at my peak of my executive functioning because I'm stable, I'm calm, I know what's happening, I know what the day is going to entail. And then it's things that happen through the day that absolutely can impact it. So, if you become overwhelmed, that's not just emotional. Overwhelm can start to impact our bodies and our brains, right? So if you think about, well, you're talking about executive functioning, you had mentioned you have all these things come at you where you're going to forget where your keys are at. So Anna, when something like that happens, because you are going to have ebbs and flows throughout your day, your week, whatever, what are some of the tools or the ways that you can almost kind of, if you catch yourself, how do you catch yourself? And what's maybe something that you can do to help you reset to kind of go, okay, well, let's just recenter here for a moment. I do a lot of breath work, things like that, but what are some of the things that you use that help you with that?
Yeah, I mean, so great question. I think at the most concrete level, I do a lot of thinking, debunking the myth of I can remember. Like I really, I think I can remember everything and I actually have a great memory and a great working memory. And when I know that I'm in one of these moments, I don't trust that part of me. And so I really take it down a few notches. And I like IFS work, internal family systems, for those who are unfamiliar around parts of self. And we have times of life and parts of our own experience where we're younger, right? We may be 45, 55, 60, in what in sort of in our chronological age, but developmentally, we may have parts of our brain or moments in time where we're really young. And so I like to think of myself in those moments as like I'm young in those moments. And so I'm going to treat myself like I'm much younger than my years. And I'm going to take care of myself differently. So I'm going to make a list that I wouldn't normally make that says, don't forget your keys, your wallet, you have an appointment at noon, which I never would normally need. My alert on my calendar would do that. But I know to pause and say, this is a vulnerable moment. I need to do this differently. I also ask for accountability from external people. So I'll say, look, listen, I need to remember this. Please help me. I break down things into their component parts much more. So even though for me, getting ready for this podcast might normally not be a problem. If I'm sleep deprived, I will make the list of like, wash your hair, blow dry it so that it's ready, and don't forget your earrings, like the things that are silly, but I would not normally not need. And I do. So I do that work. And I do also make sure that I exercise before I do things. So I get my heart rate up, even if it's 5 minutes. I also will meditate or do breath work if I need to. And I'm a person who I do much better when I have some outside time. So I will make sure to like take a walk in nature. So I do those things much more intentionally the more overloaded or more I'm struggling to try to bolster this part of myself.
I love that. And why I do is because I think about individuals and leaders that I've worked with or that have come to me, and when they're, I'm going to use the word frazzled, or when they feel scattered or reactive, the first thing they do is a lot of times they think they have to buckle down to get more done, right? Well, obviously I've got too much to do, but sometimes that pulling away and the ability to just catch your breath and come back in allows you to look at things differently. And so I'm often coaching people, when you feel like you're frozen or you're spiraling or you're shutting down, that's the moment that you want to stop and you want to pause and do some of the great things that Anna talked about. I mean, there's so many things that you can do. I'm a big nature buff as well. It just standing still and listening to the birds or the leaves blowing in the breeze. Maybe not today because it's where we were both talking about how hot it is.
Not a good day for it.
Not a good day for it. But maybe a great day to go visit a friend and have a quick cup of coffee, right? Like, it doesn't have to be an hour long. You could meet somebody for half an hour. I used to talk about how I would just reset just when I worked in the corporate office, just going from my desk to go grab a cup of tea and come back to my desk. That was my opportunity to connect with somebody on something completely different while I was waiting for the kettle to boil, so that when I came back, my mind had shifted and changed. Why does the brain do that? Can you explain maybe a little bit about that, Anna, of why the brain can sometimes feel scattered but be able to reset quickly? Is there a psychological reason behind why the brain does that? And when we talk about freezing and overwhelm?
I mean, there's a lot of different pieces of that. You know, first of all, I was just listening to another psychologist and talking about like the 90 seconds of emotions that kind of come up in like a regulatory cycle. So there's a way in which, you know, there are just moments of like emotional flooding. And then going back to what I was saying about cognitive overload, like the way the amount of information that's coming in, and then also ego depletion, which is like sort of the amount that we can control, like the emotional state we're in, like the levels of self-control. So there's a lot of things that impact that, right? The amount of information that's coming in at you from how many different sources, the amount you're trying to learn, all of these ways. And so oftentimes when we can get out of those, all of that incoming information, all of the feelings that are coming in and that overload, like our brains will naturally do this resetting process where we will go through a rapid cycle. And then if there's space, we'll say, okay, you know, great. I'm now done with that cycle, as long as there's nothing else continuing to escalate. And actually, one of the greatest examples of this is with children who get dysregulated and like roll on the floor and are having a tantrum. Mm-hmm. And we know that like those will end actually rather quickly if we are calm and we're modeled, we're like, I'm just going to go take a breath. This rarely happens. But if we did that, it would run its course so quickly. And my daughter, who has ADHD, taught me so early, she would have a huge tantrum. And I wouldn't realize for so long that I would keep the tantrum going by being like, I can't believe that you da 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 da, you know, and then she would be back and forth with me. And one day she said, can I just have a restart? And I was like, no, you cannot have a restart. You just did it, you know. And then I'm like, oh my goodness, she wants to reset and restart, and that her brain is ready for that. And I'm the one causing this to keep going. Mm-hmm. And this is so relevant for us as adults, because we stay in our central nervous system activation inadvertently by thinking like we need to fix this thing by working it through and talking and moving it through our... Like, no, we don't. We just need to restart and reset, because our brains do that naturally.
That's a great way to help people understand that cognitive wiring, because that's what's going to help us lead with more clarity too. And I see so many individuals, and you probably see it too, where they pride themselves in pushing through and carrying it all, being the fixer for things, right? And there's so many different... You mentioned a little bit about, you know, parts work and things like that, but having that ability to separate that and to be, I think first is, I guess, the recognition, right? Because once we become aware of what we're doing or how we're feeling, we're able to do something about it. What are your tips when somebody's coming to you that is just so overwhelmed, they're not even aware what's happening? What is something that you give them as a tip? Maybe to stop and pause throughout the day to kind of do a check-in. You know what? You are in this overwhelmed stage. You are in this frozen stage.
I mean, one of the things I first of all do is just to plan to check in with yourself at intentional times in the day. So like it seems, you know, for you or me, we might know to stop and check in. But I think for a lot of people, they're just going, 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 and trying to think it's like, I'm going to prevent the problem by ensuring that I do this thing that will help me slow myself down or check in. And actually, I use timers a lot to say, like, you can do this intentional work for 45 minutes, for an hour, and then you should go and go get the cup of tea that you talked about. So planning those times out, I think, is actually really important, whether or not you need them. And then it's also just doing the kind of, I mean, you mentioned it a lot, and it's clearly such an important part of your work, but the body scanning of realizing when you're anxious, like realizing when you're activated. And, you know, what I also love about the parts work is thinking in activation systems generally, is thinking about when you're speaking from a part of you versus when you're talking about a part of you. So if I'm, and like a little example, right? It's like as a leader, if I'm sitting here and I'm getting agitated in a meeting, and I'm not recognizing my agitation, then I will be, you know, I'm likely to be snippy, right? I'm likely to give an energetic kind of, okay, thanks, you know, just even if I don't mean to. Where if I scan and I'm like, oh, I'm feeling agitated, the thing that I now do that I've been really intentional about is to be like, you know, I'm so sorry, everyone. I'm feeling really agitated, and I'm realizing that the meeting isn't like going at the pace that I need it to. So how about if we all take a pause and a breath? So a lot of it is actually that self-monitoring, self-checking, speaking about something and naming it. And I think we really miss an opportunity in leadership to do that because it's so impactful for everybody and models for everyone doing that work versus just being snippy.
Yes. And I think once you are really good at that, it's your opportunity also to your point, you model it for others, but you can start to help individuals through intentional communication, right? Like, what is that shift? When somebody's off, so say somebody in your team, you know they're off, you know they're not themselves, or they have a different learning style, because I always talk about there's not a one size fits all. You can't use the same paintbrush for everybody. So it's kind of sitting back a little, observing, and then also finding ways, whether it's your team, your peers, even your family, you know, what are ways where you might be expecting everyone to process or communicate just like you? So, how is it that you can set an example, and how can you adapt or foster that? Because it's going to become a more inclusive environment when you do that. You're able to stop a meeting and not just have it be a cascade down. If you know something's off, like stop and address whatever's happening first, because people aren't going to absorb what it is you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's the, you know, so many people talk about emotional intelligence, but I really like the conceptualization of relational intelligence this way, because I think that there's, yes, emotional intelligence is wonderful, but relational intelligence, especially the leader, is so important to understand and look around the room, to know yourself, to know the other, and to understand holding both people in mind and intentionally thinking about those interactions, and to be able to give feedback from a place of real self-knowing and authenticity is the it I think really allows us to have an environment in which we are checking in with ourselves, naming our feelings, not speaking from them, speaking about them, and actually using that to know when it's time to be super empathic and when it's time to push. But because it's not actually, you know, we talk a lot about holding the other person's feelings in mind and empathy, and absolutely. And there are times when you just have to get stuff done. So I like, you know, it's like sometimes it's time to contain it. And sometimes, you know, like a great, we were talking about the news, right? And sometimes you open up a paper and you know everyone in your office has read a horrible piece of news, whether it be a plane crash or some devastating, you know, turn of events and United States, whatever it is, right? Like you can have whatever the thing is, and you know it's sitting on everyone's mind. And instead of ignoring it and pushing through everyone's sadness and just being like, okay, everybody, it's a meeting time, being able to say, hey, I know there was a really hard piece of news today, but let's all take a second and like take a breath. That was really painful to read and know about. And I'd like us all to just really try to put it away for the next 40 minutes, and then we will touch base about it afterwards. And leading that way, I think, is the way that we're sort of the intersection of this sort of neuropsychological and emotional and leadership that holds all the pieces.
Yes, definitely. And that's with anything, right? Whether it could be in somebody's personal life. I know
Totally.
I was dealing with coaching a leader, excuse me, through somebody who they had a direct report who had gone through some grief, and they just didn't seem to work at the capacity that they had previously to the grief 3 weeks later. And, you know, lo and behold, the conversation hadn't been had because the leader felt uncomfortable having it. So, what an opportunity to role play. And everybody deals with grief. We're all going to have to deal with it at some point in time. But grief isn't the same for you as it is for me, or depending on the individual that has passed, what does that grief look like? And so, we kind of role played what that conversation would be. But to your point, I think there's that fine line of empathy and compassion where, when you're at work, you still have a business to run, or when you're at home, things still need to happen. So it's finding that fine line or that balance between recognizing that they're struggling, supporting them in any way that you can, and then leading them to overhear because life is going to continue to happen, but still checking in with them every so often. Similar to like when you're a leader and you have to put somebody on a disciplinary action, you've had a tough conversation. The next day or hours later, you don't want to ignore that individual. If I've just given Anna some really tough feedback, I'm not just going to ignore her and be harder on her or try to avoid her and not make eye contact. I'm going to come up to Anna and I'm going to say, "Hey, I know that was really tough conversation that we had. How are you feeling? Do you have any questions? Let's work together to adapt or change or pivot to what we need." So I think it's being open and honest, and sometimes we're afraid to have those conversations. So,
Totally.
yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit because I know you deal with a lot of individuals that have learning differences or ADHD, cognitive overwhelm, those types of things. And, you know, if you think about, I'm going to use the corporate world, but I talked to you a little bit about North American medicine as well. I feel like sometimes there's unintentional ways that people are set up to fail. And it's hard to watch that happen because some of these individuals have so much to give and they're super, super smart. What do you feel businesses can do differently, or as a leader, what would I be able to do differently, whether that's rethinking hours, setting success measurements, setting expectations to create space for the individuals to thrive? Because again, I may not be somebody who's struggling with that and may not completely understand. What's your guidance around that?
You know, it's a great question, and I give a lot of professional developments for teachers at schools, and it feels like a very question that I answer there, which is sort of the where the line is around sort of scaffolding versus individual growth, and sort of this idea that we were talking about earlier about developmental versus chronological age. And sometimes what I would say is that you may have an employee or someone who works with you that, you know, it may look like they're a full-grown adult, but in certain parts of their brain, they're younger. Either they're more activated by emotional, social dynamics in the office, or neurocognitively, they struggle with organization. And instead of being frustrated and saying, you know, somebody needs to be this age, like they need to act their age, right? It's thinking like, well, they're struggling. So if they're struggling, what can I do to help them? What's their growth edge? So if somebody is acting like they're, you know, 15 around the quote unquote, you know, virtual water cooler, then instead of being like act your age, think about what we can do to take care of that differently. It seems like that person probably shouldn't be at the water cooler at the same time as these other people at the water cooler. That may not, as a leader, seem like your instinct on the job. You might want them to just behave differently. But I would say taking the lens of sort of best intentions and understanding that people need different things at different developmental levels is a crucial lens. And then I think in terms of some of the more concrete pieces of that, you know, more routine and more directives are actually really helpful for people who struggle in this way. So constant, but you mentioned earlier, right? Like keeping your email open and this kind of like beckon call, you know, answer me whenever, doesn't actually work well for anyone's productivity because you're kind of moving in this multitasking way that 99% of the population can't do because you're shifting sets rapidly. So actually, as a leader, recognizing that our brains don't do well responding to emails constantly, setting the example of saying, I will get back to you within 24 hours. If it is pressing, please use the terms urgent or text me, but don't assume that somebody should get back to you within the hour on an email, because then you're actually asking them to not pay attention to the other things that they need to pay attention to. So saying those things out loud, modeling them, understanding how our brains work, asking that everyone takes a lunch break, you know, asking that everyone leaves the office by a time where they actually can go do the things that they need to do in the evening. Asking for some rhythms, some routines within is helpful for everybody. Now, there are people who don't need that, but they'll kind of ignore you and move at their own rhythm anyway. So don't worry about them. Worry about the people who are struggling and try to model these different kinds of routines. So there's increased automaticity, which helps with efficiency. Try to look at the differences in terms of your different employees and look at their strengths and lean into those strengths and really name it. I mean, that's the other thing, like having hard conversations. We can talk about this endlessly, but feedback, you need to give it. You need to give it all the time. I mean, I'm not a fan actually of assessments and evaluations and quarterlies. And, if there's feedback, give the feedback. Give the feedback when they need the feedback. Not in the moment, right? It's not when I catch someone screaming, but, each week, check in. How's it going? This is what I saw. This is how I want to help. And it really changes the capacity and the ease of the practice of having hard conversations versus these big, hard evaluations that feel loaded and intense for everybody.
Yeah, you reminded me of one of my leaders. She was really good at giving me the, which is why I grew as quickly as I grew, because she gave me the space to be able to formulate my own decisions based on the information that I received, trust that I would make the right decision, but with the information I had at hand. And a lot of times it was interesting because if she didn't understand why I made the decision that I made, or she didn't completely agree with me, we would actually have the conversation, and her question would be, what might you do differently in the future if that arises? And it was just the opportunity to reflect and go, you know what? I probably would have spoken to one other person. I probably would have, whatever that thing is. And it actually helped me to grow to kind of go, okay, well, next time I know, as opposed to just repeating the same thing all the time. And then I loved how you talked about boundaries, because boundaries are big for me, but also in the work that I do and my podcasts. I really believe boundaries are important. And I think so many people struggle with boundaries because they feel that they're selfish, that they're not going to be successful if they set up these boundaries, whether it's with family, whether it's with work. And so I often talk about, let's start with small boundaries and why it's important to communicate what your boundaries are, because you've been doing X for so long, now you're going to shift how you do things. You have to bring people along with you. So if you're the kind of person who has jumped on every email every time it's landed, and now you're going to check it once or twice a day and respond, just let your people know that that's what you're going to do so that you can be more present in X, Y, and Z, right? So I think that's important.
Exactly. Yeah, I love boundary. One of the I will never forget the first time when I first had my first child, I made this decision to not work on weekends. And one of my clients was like, "Who the hell do you think you are to not work on the weekends?" And I remember really questioning myself and being scared. And then I just doubled down on it. And I said, "I think I'm a person who needs to take the weekends off, so, and that's going to make me my best self." And I started setting a vacation responder for every weekend. And I did that for a decade. And I cannot tell you the number of people who wrote me back and said, "Oh my goodness, this is the best idea ever. Thank you so much for setting a vacation responder." And it's come to the point, over the last 6 months, I haven't had to set a vacation responder because no one contacts me over the weekends. And it's like, I'm not going to get back to you. I don't think you need to respond on a weekend. It's called a weekend so that we get some time to restore ourselves. And it shouldn't be an expectation. And it shouldn't be an expectation that at like 6 p.m. on a Friday that someone's writing me about a Monday morning meeting. Like, no, thank you. And if when you set those parameters, it really impacts everyone in a positive way and by that modeling.
Yes, definitely. And I think people start to, because I always used to believe too, and I found this really interesting. It was a test that I tried really early on in my career. When you're the go-to person all the time, and all of a sudden you set those boundaries, similar to what I said earlier, listen, Anne, I want to help you, but I'm just focused on this right now. Why don't you go and block some time in my calendar and I'll devote attention to you? Sometimes that individual is able to formulate the answer for themselves. It was easier for them to try and come and ask you for the answer than for them to actually reflect, think, and come up with a solution. And I think when you do those boundaries, it helps individuals to grow and to develop because now they're having to think for themselves, or when they're coming to you and you actually have that time, they're coming with solutions or they're coming with more concrete questions than just the general, what should I do in this situation? They've done some of their homework. And I think, you doing that on the weekends probably had people kind of going, I've got the tools. I know what I need to do. I just need to do it.
And I actually think that what you just named on the professional development I just gave, we had that exact conversation. Like kids who say over and over and over again, like, where's the, how do I do the, and adults do it all the time too. Oh, when are we doing that thing? Or how are we doing that thing? And being able to say to someone, you know, if you don't mind checking the resource folder, if you don't mind asking someone else about that, feeling free to have a boundary about the expectations of you being a resource to other people. You know, I am someone who I'm resourced in a particular way around time and managing things, and people I love can always come to me. I'm happy to help out. But sometimes I would find myself, you know, getting messages like, where's that restaurant? And I was like, Google Maps, people, you know, or like, look it up. And so you really do have to understand, you know, at that moment, if I start to feel resentful or frustrated or upset, that's what I have to listen to. You know, it's okay if I don't. But also, is that beneficial to the relationship if I keep answering that question when I really don't want to? No, it's not. And then I'm going to get to the point where I'm saying I'm frustrated, but I didn't tell them I was frustrated. So you have to be able to communicate that and those limits and boundaries so that everyone gets their needs met, also so that they grow and learn, also so that it doesn't turn sour.
Yes. Well, and in turn, it helps them. You're always leading by example. So it's teaching others not only how to do it, but once they start doing it, it's teaching whoever they work with or their families or whatever that looks like, right? And I always feel like as a leader, your skill set, aside from hopefully supporting you and being a very successful leader, is around, I talk often about, sending the elevator down and seeing who wants to come up. What are you doing to help set up whoever's that next, maybe your successor, or maybe the next person who's going to get a promotion? What does that look like? How are you influencing it and making their world a better place, as opposed to just the doing and sitting in the throne yourself and functioning for yourself? So, Anna, for the leader right now who's listening, because I know we gave a lot of information, I want to talk a little bit too about some of the stuff that you do so people know what it is you do. But if there's a leader right now that's just sitting there going, and that's typical, right? I'm stuck, I'm overwhelmed, I'm questioning everything that I do. What's the first step that they can take to reclaim that clarity and confidence? Where should they start? Because this was a lot of information, and they may go, yeah, okay, well, that's great, but what's the first thing that I should do?
What a great question. I mean, I think the first thing is actually a sort of reflection. It's a self-reflection. And so one of the things I work with my clients on is making a guidebook to working with me. And so that the idea is that you should actually learn yourself as the first thing that you're doing as a leader. So, you know, you need to sit down and write out what it means to work with me. So for example, I like to say emailing me is understanding that I have a million and 10 things going on, and that the brevity and form in my email in no way reflects how I feel about you. Like, you know, that I'm going to be short in my emails. Please excuse me. It's not meant to be rude, but I'm not going to take the time to say, like, you know, how are you? How are things going? I hope you're well. If you work for me, like, that's not a thing that I'm able to do. If you need me urgently, you should text me. You should say urgent. You know, if I'm seeming snippy, please, or you're upset by something I've said, please do bring it up. Like, feedback and criticism for me is a love language. I'd love to hear what you think and how you feel about things. If you're having a hard day, please tell me. These are the ways in which I want to show up. So it's the moment of, if you're overwhelmed, you should be stopping and taking a pause and almost like thinking about organizing who you are and how you show up and seeing yourself metacognitively. Like, what is it I want to look and see myself and see how I'm showing up, because that's going to give you crucial information about the changes that you need to make and the ways in which you want to model differently.
And I think it's okay to ask. And I think that's the other piece, right? Sometimes if you're a good leader, your team will feel confident giving you feedback. But you have to be non-judgmental when you get that feedback.
Yeah, not defensive. You have to say thank you and mean it. You have to say thank you and mean it.
To your point, it's a love language. I often use this. People would say, "Well, that's not true because that's not what I meant or that's not what I did." And I was like, "But perception is valid. Like perception is truth to them. So just because that may not have been your intention, the perception by the other person receiving it was that was your intention. So now, how do you fix that? How do you adjust that to be able to make sure that that relationship is repaired if it was a difficult conversation or something like that."
Yeah. I mean, I love David Cooley's work on this, and he does the restorative relationship approach, which is based on restorative justice. And it just is such a simple conceptualization that I find that I utilize every day, which is that we each have our own truth. There's no objective truth. And that's actually very hard to sit with. I mean, I cannot tell you the number. I work with high conflict couples as my like side clinical practice. The number of times people say, "Those are the facts." And it's like, not here, they're not, you know, because you're, and if you're speaking in, from your feelings, which is what we should be doing, there are no truths and facts. You know, it's how you felt about the thing. So if you say to me, "You were snippy," I might prefer you say, "I felt hurt by the way you talked to me," but I can't say, "I wasn't being hurtful," because you felt hurt. And therefore, the thing that I want to say is, "I really didn't intend to hurt you. Thank you for letting me know. Can you tell me what it was about the way that I was speaking to you?" And often, you know, it's like, "Well, you were really pressured and you seemed distracted." It's like, "Ah, oh, thank you so much for telling me. I was distracted. My child had just called me. I was really preoccupied. It had nothing to do with you. I'm so sorry." Or, "Actually, I was feeling annoyed. Can I tell you why I was feeling annoyed?" So you want consent to have these hard conversations, but the same way you would do in partnerships, in any kind of employee, employer, employee to employee conversations, there are multiple truths and they can be held because everyone's feelings are different. And that's a crucial part of having these kinds of interactions.
Yeah, and sometimes it's the person that you're speaking to that has the feeling. Maybe it wasn't you, maybe it's how they're feeling or something that just occurred to them, that when you said whatever it was you had to say, it actually was, it felt like a knife that was stabbing me, just because prior to that I had had a, you know, an argument with my partner, with my child, whatever it is. And so that emotion may not be relevant to the conversation we're having, but it's going to come up because I didn't deal with it. So I think that's the other piece, is when we try to hold and bottle those emotions. I often talk about, you know, if you keep trying to shove all these emotions down, I visualize it as being Pandora's box. At some point, it's going to be full and it's going to explode, and that's not going to be good. So how do we avoid that and sit with it? And that's the parts work and stuff. But yeah, that's beautiful. I love, you know, the open communication is the key at the end of the day,
It
right?
really
It
is.
really is. So yeah. And I ask every guest that comes on my episode one question, and it's, what's the biggest lesson you've learned through your journey that changed how you show up today? And how can our listeners apply that insight so that they can lead with more clarity, calm, and real impact?
I think I've touched on this a little bit in terms of the self-reflection, but I think I can be even more intentional in my communication by saying, leading with your vulnerability in a boundaried way. And what I mean by that is, I don't speak from my feelings, but I do speak about them, and I do speak about what's going on in my life really openly. So if there is something that is impacting my work, I name it and I really like claim it as mine. So, you know, my father-in-law passed away, and, you know, my partner was really struggling, and I was coming to work with a different energy. And I don't let that go and pretend that's not happening, but I name it in a boundary way. And I also say what I need from other people in it. So I say, "I just want to let everyone know my father-in-law passed away. You know, I'm actually doing well. I just have to spend a lot of energy. It was his time. It was okay. And also, I'm grieving and I'm supporting a family in grief. So I'm going to be more distracted right now. I'm going to be less available to you." And really, what I would so appreciate is everyone just being a little bit more intentional about asking for my time during this period when I'm feeling more depleted. Right. So there's a lot of things built into that communication around what I'm disclosing. I'm not asking anyone else to hold it. I'm directing them to the care and need that I have in it and what I want from them. But I'm being vulnerable in what I'm communicating. And I think that that helps people not speak from, you know, it models that thing we were talking about, right? Of let's be honest, let's be transparent, let's be in our vulnerability, but let's also be boundaried and respectful of other people's ways of being with and also helping being asking for care by naming the way we need care.
That is beautiful. I can't think of a better way to say that. And you've actually given the listeners a tool for them to document, and I'll make sure it's in the show notes of here are the steps. Here's kind of what you want to cover to make sure that you're communicating effectively. Because sometimes you just may say, well, I'm dealing with grief. My father-in-law passed away, but I love how you expressed how that's going to impact you and how you're going to show up. So just giving me a bit more space and maybe not relying me on as much, right? So thank you. Love that. Anna, can you share a little bit about, I know you've got Dwellness and we didn't talk a lot about that, but Steel Advising, I think, is the one where you support leaders, et cetera. Maybe share a little bit about what's available to those that are listening if they'd love to get in touch with you and get some more help.
Sure. I mean, we basically are an adult coaching company that focuses on strengthening executive functions in order to flourish in work and life, and really thinking about we work with teams, we work with individuals, often with CEOs, to really think about how we add efficiency and effectiveness and strategically consider all of the things we've talked about today around hard conversations and emotions in the intersections of team building and systems. And yeah, really think about rapport also, which we didn't really get to talk about today, but relationship to me is the most important thing. And that's about match and about thinking about people you're comfortable with. Because this kind of coaching, it's interesting. I'm a psychologist and as a therapist, people can come in and tell me what they want to tell me. But as a coach, I'm like, open up your email, let me see it. So you really have to feel comfortable with the person that you're sitting with in a different way. And so we do a lot of work on making sure it's a great personality fit as a part of the what we do. And yeah, that job is just, the job that I have is wonderful because I'm meant to be rendered useless. And I think that that's a beautiful part of my work.
That's great. Yes. And that's, even as a coach, right? At some point, you don't want to be coaching somebody every day for the rest of their
No, please no.
life. Because otherwise, you haven't done what you need to do.
Internalize, right, internalize that change. That's what I need from you.
Yes. Yes. And Anna has also included, I'm going to add it in the show notes, an article called the Fast Company article. I don't know if you want to talk about that a little bit, but I'll make sure I include that in the show notes for everybody to take a look at.
Oh, that's great. I don't love to talk about the things I've written or that's one of my worst characteristics as a leader that I know, this is where my psychologist self really hides in my back room. But I do think that this idea of looking at your executive functions, like looking through that lens is extremely helpful in leadership to look at the ways in which we can be more efficient and effective. It's at like that brain level versus just that more vague category.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Anything else you want to leave our listeners with before we end our call today?
No, thank you so much for having me. I'm grateful. I love these kinds of conversations. It's just exciting to be sharing and being with people who are thinking this way.
Yes, I think we need to get more people focused on that, and that's how we do it is by sharing more, right? So thank you
Yeah,
so much.
absolutely.
Thanks so much for your time, Anna. I truly enjoyed our time together.
Okay, I'm nice to meet you.
You too.